page on the web at business.talkcity.com.
It's 6 minutes now past 11 o'clock. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Well, it took nine long ballots, but late Saturday night, delegates at the DFL State Convention finally made their important decision. Chisholm State Senator Jerry Janicich is the party's endorsed candidate for the U.S. Senate race against Republican incumbent Rod Grams. Senator Janicich went into the convention as one of the presumed front runners, and he never trailed in the voting, but victory did not come easy. It took hours and hours of debate and discussion before Senator Janicich was able to prevail over the other six candidates. And the future doesn't look all that easy either. He now has to win the party's primary in September, and he faces three strong challengers, trial attorney Michael Cerisi, Twin Cities business executive Rebecca Yanish, and former state auditor Mark Dayton. All of them are at least as well known as Senator Janicich, and all of them have far more money to spend. Senator Janicich officially kicks off his primary campaign at 12:30 this afternoon, but he's come by our studios today to talk about his win over the weekend, his plans for the campaign, and his position on the issues. And we invite you to join our conversation if you have a question or comment for the DFL party's endorsed candidate for the U.S. Senate, State Senator Jerry Janicich. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Senator Janicich, thanks for coming in today.
It's a pleasure.
Have you had a chance to catch your breath yet?
Not really. Not really. It's just been an amazing thing. Amazing. Truly remarkable. It went just like I dreamt it. You know, you couldn't ask for anything better. Other than maybe about the fourth or fifth ballot rather than the ninth.
Mm-hmm. Were you, in your heart of hearts, before the convention, convinced you were going to win, or was there some real doubt in your mind as to how it was really going to turn out?
I think that there's always doubt. In my heart of hearts, I thought I would win, but do you doubt it? Yes. And we knew going in where we were, there was such a great amount of undecided that we thought there were tons of things that could have happened that would have turned it any different direction. But we knew, we had a pretty good feel of where our numbers were, and we ended up right where we thought we'd be after the first ballot. After that, our goal was just to hold that and build, mm-hmm. and we were able to do that.
How important was that speech that you gave before? The thinking was that all of the candidates' speeches prior to the voting were going to be very critical because there were so many people who were undecided, didn't know who they were going to support, and that they had said, well, I want to listen to all the candidates. And not only did you give a well-received speech, but a very unusual approach. You brought out this soapbox for people who weren't listening, paying attention this weekend, brought out this soapbox, set it up in front of the podium rather than speaking from the podium, got up on this soapbox without notes, and gave a speech that was very, very well received. Do you think that swayed a lot of minds?
Well, I think there are a lot of people out there who thought it was a good speech. We thought going in that it would make a difference. There's lots of the people there hadn't heard me. There's always questions going in about different candidates and what they believe in, and we wanted to let people know that we wanted to be part of them. We didn't want to feel separated from them. We believe that connecting with them is what it's all about. We wanted people to know that we're going to be pretty traditional. I believe that we're getting away from what we used to be. Instead of taking elections to the people, we've become all about sound bites on TV and about money. And we're not going to be like that. I want them to know that we're going to go out, we're going to touch them, we're going to go to work, and we're going to let them know who we are.
You must have been nervous as a cap, though, because everybody else, you know, traditionally, at least you've got some notes in case you forget what you're supposed to say.
You can look back. There's a certain amount of what I do that is a little risky, all right? But I have a tendency to speak from my heart and my gut, and most of it is stuff that I know and I feel, and I want people to know that. I think part of where we're at is we've become too messaged. And when you're on message all the time, people don't get to know who you are and what you are. And I don't think that's fair to them or fair to yourself, actually. I mean, early on in the campaign, people kept saying, well, Jerry, you have to stay on message. I just want to be Jerry. I want people to know who Jerry is. I want them to feel good about supporting me when the time comes. I want them to know that I'm not irrational, okay, that I do think about things. And I want them ultimately to say, hey, when I vote for this guy, it's going to be because he's not going to be either far to the right, far to the left. He's going to think about it and make good, strong decisions based on people.
There were some comparisons made over the weekend to Jesse Ventura. You and Jesse Ventura, kind of regular people, and that's the big appeal that you bring to the race. Is that legitimate?
I think some of that's legitimate. I think the biggest difference is that I have done some of these things. I have governed. I do know what it takes to govern. I've been governing from a county board to the state senate, and I know that sometimes you can't necessarily deliver what you say, so you shouldn't say it. And that this whole thing, this whole process is, if you just break it down simply to doing what's right for people, it works. And politics is not bad. Politics is good. And that part I disagree with the governor on. I mean, he villainizes people who are doing it, and at the same time now he's doing it. And there's nobody I know in the legislature or county boards or city councils or school boards who are villains. They do it because they believe in it, and most of the time it's pretty tough decision-making. And I think that part is the most important part of this. Government is in everybody's lives. And what is happening today, corporations are getting there too. I mean, I would be more worried about what happened with Northwest Airlines coming in and taking the computers out of those people's homes to track during that airline strike deal with stewardess. That would bother me a lot more than where government goes. Mm. And I think that the difference probably be between Ventura and I is I have done it. I have governed. I do know that sometimes you make some tough decisions, but if you do it based on people and what they believe and what you believe, you get there.
One more question. I want to get to some listeners here. You've won the party's endorsement now, but as a practical matter, what does that mean? There was a lot of criticism of the party 2 years ago, indicating that, well, it's nice to get the endorsement, but they basically sat on their hands during the primary campaign and said, well, we'd be glad to help the candidate, but we're going to wait till after the general election. Do you expect the same thing to happen this time?
I'm not going to let them. Okay, I will not let them. I will engage them. They will be part of the campaign, and I believe they will help. If they let this opportunity pass, they will do a great injustice, I believe, to the people of Minnesota. Part of which one of those candidates there on Saturday would not have taken that endorsement? Mike would have taken that endorsement right to the end. I mean, he lasted 9 ballots fighting for that thing. Rebecca was there. Mark was there. Okay, in fact, he was there on Sunday shaking hands. Anybody that was there knows that it had a value. Which one of them woke up Sunday morning to their name on the front page of any paper? Which one of them? Today we've been in Rochester, we've been in St. Cloud, and we've been in Winona, and now we're on this program. Who of that group wouldn't have wanted to be doing this right now today? Instead, what they're going to do is have to spend their money. They're going to have to buy this kind of time. I'm not going to have to buy this time. We're going to go up to Bemidji tonight. Tomorrow we're going to head down. We're going to hit media outlets all the way down. It's about being the DFL endorsed candidate and bringing your message to people. They're going to have to buy that. I'll take that anytime. Sunday morning, when we were at the convention, people from all over the state were coming into our office, signing up as volunteers, and signing up for events, telling us when things were going on. They're going to have to go out and do all that legwork. We're not going to have to do that. Politics is about people. I still believe it, and I believe that we can get this thing done from the bottom up. What we did and what we'll be doing in the next couple, 3 days is going to cost them some money.
But they have it.
So let them spend it. All right? The goal, I believe, is to make the process work, which is about people of low to moderate middle income and people who don't have the money. If politics becomes money, we might as well all go home. you'll have nothing to report. You know, you won't have like Saturday if it's about money. Whoever has the money, we just let them go. We'll let the five richest people run for public office, and whoever can buy it off buys it off. And Washington will have Senator number 86, who's a millionaire and has a ton of wealth, and we'll have no more representation from working men and women. I don't think that's what we want. I don't, unless America looks like that, that's what, if 86 out of 100 people are millionaires and that's the way we look, so be it. But I don't think we look like that. And I hope the people that are listening today and that will be listening through this campaign understand that the gap, the income gap that was 40-1 in 1980 between the haves and the have-nots is 400-1 today, and that's about who makes public policy, and I don't think we should let that get further away.
All right, our guest this hour is the DFL-endorsed candidate for the U.S. Senate, State Senator Jerry Janicich, and if you have a question for Senator Janicich, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Charles, go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to know what committees you would be most interested in serving on, and two, what's your stand on defense spending?
I had early on committed to, said right out of the get-go that I wanted to serve on agriculture. Most of Minnesotans, most of the Minnesotans that had gone to the U.S. Senate, like the Humphreys and the Mondales, and actually even McCarthy, did serve on ag. I believe that it's just one of the most basic thing. Food is the most basic thing going on in our country, and I think that the agriculture and in this country, how we're doing it, isn't quite working. And not that I'm an expert on it, but what I believe is that by serving on the committee and paying attention, you become smarter and you become better at doing stuff. That's what I've done in the House and in the Senate, was get on the committee and learn about the issues and then make the decisions. So that would be one of the things. Defense spending, until you know what you have, you have to be pretty careful on what you're doing here. If you take a look at the president and was in Russia over the summit, and they had come to what I thought was 16. They said they came to 16 conclusions, which to me, after I was done reading them, looked like they came to a conclusion to disagree, but to continue to keep on talking about trying to get to some point to agree. And that's the short version for what I thought they had in 16 points. Do I want nuclear proliferation? No, I don't want that. But I do want our people to make, I do want our people in the service to make a decent wage so they aren't on food stamps. I do want the equipment that we do have to work. I want to make sure that when we are up and ready, that we can have the capabilities to be up and ready to address anything that might happen in the world. We need to lead. And I do also want to make sure that we use the United Nations in any attempt or any kind of engagement in the world. And I don't believe we should use food as a weapon. I mean, I just can't imagine why we would starve people for military gain. In this world today, there's a billion people today who are going to live on a dollar. I'm not so sure any of us would like to meet that challenge. I know I wouldn't. I couldn't do it. And so I think that those are just some of the thoughts I have right now without looking through a bunch of paper that and information that some people have that I don't have.
Mm-hmm. Robert, your question, please.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you, Jerry. My question is about, related to the previous callers, is about defense, and particularly the idea of this national missile defense. You know, Clinton has now raised the idea of perhaps abrogating on the ABM treaty and pursuing building a limited missile defense system, and Bush has pushed that idea even further. And I guess I would want to ask you, I mean, this is, you know, the amount of money that we're spending on defense in our country, and especially building something like Star Wars, will take a huge amount of money, and it's been very controversial for many years. And I think it's really important that a serious Senate candidate really understands this issue. And I'd like to know, what do you think are the pros and cons of Star Wars? And is this something, would you support the deployment of it, or would you oppose it?
And I think you have a good question. And I believe you're right. A serious Senate candidate should have a good feel for this. But don't you find it a little ironic that Cohen even offered Bush to come in to spend some time to learn about the issue a little better, so he had a better feel for that thing? I don't believe a serious Senate candidate should just be going off talking about things that even serious presidential candidates are just opinionating. Do I want us to have a safe and secure nation? Yes. Do I want Russia to come to some sort of agreement with us? Yes. Do I think that if they have some doubts about what we're doing, that we should have some doubts? You bet. But do I believe that I need more information? Yes. Am I going to go out and seek that in the next 2 or 3 months? Yes, because I think you're right. I do believe that as a serious Senate candidate, I need to be up and strong on the issue, and I want to go out and get the information, and we're going to try to put something together to go and do just that.
Let me ask you this. So let's assume that the administration finally decides, when all is said and done, that the weapon system, the missile defense system, should be deployed. The Russians are obviously opposed to this. Should they essentially have veto power over what we do?
I think in a world economy, in a global system, that we should pay attention to what they do want and don't want. I think that's part of what we did. We still are the leader in this country and in this nation and in this world, and I think that if they want veto power, they're going to have to agree to some other things. So I would guess probably not.
Okay. Beth, your question, please.
Hi, Senator. I'm wondering what your stand will be on gay and lesbian rights. Well, specifically domestic partner rights in health insurance and in end-of-life decision-making, and also in adoption issues.
I've always been a supporter of nurturing and loving relationships. I don't have any. I think they should have health care benefits. I think if they do want to adopt, they should adopt. I just have no problem with that. Where we live and where I was born and raised, it was about nationalities. I think by now we should have just learned it should be about relationships and people. And so I don't have a problem with any of those.
Mm-hmm. Zoe, your question, please.
Hi. My question is, I think a lot of these new rulings will have to start with our state. My question is, what is your stance on gun control? Because I don't think anybody has the answer, but we have to start developing some format for handling this locally, even if it's within a city limit, such as the latest shooting with this young person on River Road. It could happen anywhere at any time. And I think even the police force might be confused. You know, where do they start with this? What are they going to do when young people might have something in their car, and just for kicks now it goes from fireworks to guns.
Okay.
Any ideas on how to start with some issues locally on gun control?
First of all, Minnesota has some of the strongest gun control policies in the nation, and I think that we should think about taking some of that to Washington. In Minnesota, we have waiting periods. Do I believe everybody should be carrying a gun? Absolutely not. In Minnesota, we have a policy of how you go through the process to get a gun. You go to the sheriff, or you go to the local police chief to get it to carry. Enforcement, I think, is big. Training. We don't spend a lot of time in all over Minnesota on how and what can happen to guns. I think we should have the gun lock on them. There's nothing the matter with that. When somebody goes to gun shows, we should start thinking, we should register people right there on the spot. And you should be able to show that you have the ability or the knowledge of the gun before you take it. And I think those are pretty basic things. I mean, we shouldn't be so far. Well, the NRA isn't right all the time, period.
President Clinton has suggested that guns should be registered, gun owners should be licensed. Would you agree with those positions?
I think most gun owners that I know wouldn't care about that at all. Okay, most gun owners I know use them for hunting.
So you'd support
something like that? Common sense, common sense approach to guns makes good sense for everybody. And most of the people that I know that hunt and use them for hunting, they don't care. And most of the people that I know that buy them, all right, they'll buy one a month. So, and they'll gladly give their name. I don't believe that it's that big a deal.
Rebecca, your question, please.
Hi, thanks. When I heard you were a bar owner, the first questions that came to my mind were, one, how did you vote on the Minnesota bill to lower the legal blood alcohol limit to 0.08, and how do you feel about tougher drunk driving laws?
Rebecca, in Minnesota, currently we have some of the toughest drunk driver laws around. Plus, we do have, particularly for more than once offender. And I've never had a problem with doing that. I have not voted to lower the minimum drinking down to the 0.08. Even the federal government has come out with some studies that say that doesn't matter other than put some people in bad spots. And I guess that's where I've been, and that's probably where I would continue to be.
Vicki's up next with a question for State Senator Jerry Janicich. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. Senator Janicich, we're spending $18 billion nationally on the war on drugs. We're spending $2.5 billion right now in the war in Colombia. We have mandatory minimum requirements. We're building more prisons, putting more people away in our prison industrial complex. We're taking items away from people in civil asset forfeiture laws. We have refused to change the Controlled Substances Act by taking marijuana out of Schedule 1 and putting it into another schedule. We have not allowed people to grow hemp. Instead, we import hemp for commercial purposes. What's your position on all of those drug laws?
Well, Vicki, I've actually supported the hemp initiative in the state. I voted to do that the last couple of times. I believe that on most of what we're spending on the marijuana piece, particularly, that we should start thinking about using it for medical purposes and see how that works. I'm not convinced yet in my mind that we want to legalize that. I've definitely gone through that process in my life. I think, like everybody else that's 50 years old today, and I don't think that I'm ready for that. My 16-year-old son tells me it's easier to do that. It's easier, in fact, not only my 16-year-old son, Adam, who I met at the convention this weekend, said it's easier to find pot at school than it is to get a pencil. And I'm not convinced we want that to be where we're at.
But given the fact that it is already so readily available, doesn't that say to you that what we're doing right now just isn't working?
Do I believe probably it's not working? Yeah. Am I ready to legalize it? I'm not sure. All right. I think that's a pretty big step. Okay. I think we'd probably be better off using some of the older methods, the education method, more education, making it more of a topic in our schools. And the results of what can happen. I find that cigarette smoking, when we started to really spend our time educating, that it has tapered off. And I particularly notice that because of what I do, okay, in the bar.
Mm-hmm.
People are paying a lot more attention to smoking. In fact, we get a bad time all the time from some of our customers because of the smoke that, you know, ends up in the bar, and the customers don't particularly like it. So I think that the education process can work, and we need to continue to work through that on the drug stuff. We're not there yet, I don't believe.
Our guest this hour is Minnesota State Senator Jerry Janicich, who this weekend was endorsed by the DFL party as its candidate for the U.S. Senate race against Republican Rod Grams. Now, Senator Janicich is not home yet, not home free yet. He still has to win the primary in September, and he faces a strong challenge from three well-known candidates, trial attorney Michael Cerisi, Twin Cities business executive Rebecca Yanish, and former state auditor Mark Dayton. Senator Janicich has come by today. He's kicking off his primary campaign at 12:30 this afternoon. He stopped by our studios to take your question. So if you have a question for Senator Janicich, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to some more callers here in just a couple minutes.
Programming on NPR is supported in part by News Radio 1330, WMNN. Providing quick news, weather, and traffic updates at 1330 a.m., complementing the in-depth news and analysis on NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeffrey Eugenides, author of the novel The Virgin Suicides, which was recently adapted into a film. In The New Yorker and Grantham magazine, he's been hailed as one of the best young writers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins at 8 o'clock this evening. Time now for news headlines. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Good morning, Gary. Grandparents have come out on the losing end of a battle over their rights to visit their grandchildren against parents' wishes. The U.S. Supreme Court has struck down a law that gave grandparents broad rights to seek court-ordered visitation. The justices ruled today that as long as a parent adequately cares for his or her children, there is usually no reason for the state to get involved. The vote was 6-3, but spawned six separate opinions. In another U.S. Supreme Court ruling, the justices have set aside a Texas death sentence after prosecutors conceded race was a factor in the man's sentencing. The justices have told a Texas court to give Victor Hugo Saldano a new sentencing hearing. He was convicted of kidnapping and murdering a man near Dallas in 1996. During his sentencing hearing, a prosecution witness said the fact that Saldano is Hispanic was a factor in weighing in favor of future dangerousness. Attorneys for Saldano told the Supreme Court it was fundamentally unfair for prosecutors to use race and ethnic stereotypes to get the death penalty. Ukraine's president says Chernobyl nuclear power plant will be shut down. President Clinton was in Kiev for today's announcement. The two leaders had a brief meeting, and it followed a two-day summit in Moscow between Clinton and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Chernobyl is the site of the world's worst nuclear accident. In regional news, a Waseca County grand jury will hear evidence in the death of 12-year-old Callie Jo Larson. Waseca County Attorney Larry Collins and Attorney General Mike Hatch had asked for the grand jury. Callie Jo was found dead in her home after returning from school on September 20, 1999. She had been sexually assaulted, stabbed, and hanged. The grand jury is scheduled to convene on June 27th at a location to be determined. No arrests are anticipated before the grand jury meets to hear evidence. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for mostly sunny skies statewide. High temperatures today ranging from 68 to 70 degrees. And for tonight, mostly clear skies with lows in the 40s. At this hour, St. Cloud reports sunshine in 58 degrees. It's sunny in Rochester in 54. Duluth reports sunshine in 59. And in the Twin Cities, sunny skies, a temperature of 56. Gary, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. It's about 26 minutes before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, and our guest this hour is State Senator Jerry Janicich from Chisholm, who this weekend was endorsed by the DFL party as its candidate for the U.S. Senate race this fall against Republican Rod Grams. Senator Janicich still faces a tough primary battle. That primary, of course, will be held in September. As part of our Meet the Candidates series, he's come by today to take your questions. So, again, if you have a question for Senator Janicich, give us a call. But don't call right now because all of our lines are busy. Just wait a few minutes till we get to some callers. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Organized labor, is one of your key supporters through the endorsement fight. Just to give people a better sense of where you stand on a variety of issues, is there anything you disagree with in terms of organized labor's position on the issues? Any place you disagree with them on?
Well, I would say very few. All right. It seems to me that I think there's some things that are going on in our nation today that we should pay attention to. In a world economy, if history teaches us anything, labor, young people, and the environmental community have always been our social conscience, all right? And in a world economy, labor, the environmental community, and our young people were together to march in Seattle against the WTO and world trade for the most part, or at least they wanted to be a part of the discussion. And we should pay attention to that. Part of how we have the standard of living for the most part that we have is because of the social conscience of them, of those three groups. And I think that where we're headed today, we should probably pay a lot more attention to labor. I mean, labor's thought that everybody should have health care is not a bad idea. That somebody making $4.55 an hour can't make a living is not a bad, you know, I mean, that's kind of bad. And that $6.15 an hour is not enough money. Their idea that doing nothing but work is a good idea. You know, that doesn't make any sense. The working men and women today are working longer than they ever have, and for the most part, accepting that. And we probably shouldn't be, especially when the gap has grown. The environmental community and their current concerns about where we're headed in a world economy, we should pay attention to what they're talking about. The standards and that we've had to maintain because of where they brought corporate America should be all over the world, because our kids are going to live in that.
Mm-hmm. Are you too close to big labor, though? I mean, after all, when push comes to shove, they only represent a relatively small fraction of workers in America. They have their own agenda. Are you too close to them, or just kind of do their bidding if you get elected to the Senate?
I can't imagine being too close to working men and women. And I don't know what big labor, for the most part, is. The steel workers that I know, I don't consider them big labor. The IBW people that I know don't appear to be big labor. The nurses don't appear to be big labor. Railroad workers, they all seem to me like just being average people who go to work every day who want a voice. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. Anybody, the secretaries, waitresses, that doesn't appear to be big labor to me. They just appear to be people who want the same things that everybody else wants. They want to be able to make a living. They want to be able to bring up their children. They want their children to go to school. I think if I get accused of siding with big labor and that's bad, then I'm bad, okay? But I just don't think they're big labor. I just think they're common, ordinary people, and I'll take that anytime.
Ed, your question, please.
Yes, good morning. It's nice and refreshing to hear someone actually admit they are going to study and look into items that they're not aware of or not familiar with. I like that a lot. And while I can't support your gun control issues, I do admire you for speaking the truth and speaking your mind. What I'm interested in is what your ideas would be for our mining industry up in northern Minnesota over the next 10 or 15 years for our younger generation, people that live up there and don't care to have to relocate. I'd appreciate your answer, and I'll take your answer off the air.
Hi, Ed. Good morning. We have a long way to go, I believe, and I think part of what we're experiencing with LTV is telling us that, and that's part of a world economy, too. When we can't get a price for our goods and services, then we're in big trouble, and when corporate America doesn't want to invest there, we're in big trouble. So I think part of where we need to go is number one, the direct reduction, and take us into what I believe is the next technology. We have plenty of product. We have plenty of material there to mine. I think what we need to do is use the technology that's out there to get into a little different market and still maintain the base. When you take a look at the industry and you take a look at the other companies who I believe are going to be there for a long time, they've invested and done some things internally to make their product more competitive. At LTV, I think we best figure out a way. Well, we got a couple things going for us, I think, there. Number one is Representative Rukavina and I had passed a law a couple years back that says that after they even close the place, they have to leave everything standing. And that at least means we maybe can look for another investor. It also, when people talk about $500 to $700 million as being a huge investment into the plant, I think they need to think about, well, $500 to $700 million investment there is about a 30-year commitment. And when you make that type of investment, you spread it out over a 30-35-year commitment, it doesn't appear to be that kind of an investment. So I think that those are possibilities. I think there's some people who are looking at doing some other things with that piece of property and with the facility. So the goal, I think, should be to take a look at what we can use the facility for. Do not let anybody take it down, because you can't build anything like that. Take a good, strong look at other investors. Maybe take a look at using our agency up there, the IRRB, and how we can invest. And I'm very glad to have seen that the governor has definitely made this, through using his commissioners, has made it a priority. So as disappointed as I was that he thought it was like shutting down your favorite fishing hole, I was happy to see that he still sent up his commissioners to take a good look at it and are working with us to try to get there.
Is much of the discontent in this country over global trade issues, do you think much of it is rooted in the fact that when people are dislocated, they lose their job because of World Trade and so on, there isn't a sufficient safety net for them?
I don't think there's ever a sufficient safety net. How do you move Ed, let's say, from White Lakes to Michigan, where there may or may not be an opportunity, his family, his home, the businesses that are in White Lakes? I don't think you could ever create a safety net that would be big enough for that type of thing. How do you completely uplift people and their lives and move them anywhere and think that that's a good deal, or to think that, well, all right, now we're going to give you a $7 an hour job, being the janitor or whatever it is, and that doesn't affect them. I just see Ed's life and his family's life, you know, as an example. You can never, ever, ever create a safety net good enough or better, big enough for them to do that. What's happening? What's happening there in a lot of places in rural Minnesota? When you force people to leave, you devastate communities, you devastate schools, you change everybody's lives. Even if they have an opportunity that may look like an opportunity somewhere else, Hoyt Lakes and Aurora, that area. What happens to that when you lose 1,400 jobs, especially if you take a look at the economic impact of something like that and the personal impact? 1,400 jobs of $45,000 a year, multiply that by 7, and then take a look at, which is what the dollar is supposed to roll over, then take a look at how many people that affects after that. They're not all going to be able to be waitresses and waiters at Giants Ridge or in the hotel at Giants Ridge in Blavik. I mean, it doesn't make any sense for us to do that. I think we best figure out a way in making sure that our competition in a global economy gets to where we are. I compare where we're headed in the same direction as when my dad went on strike, went on strike anyway, because I think we need to go out into the world now and upgrade the mentality and educate everybody so that they know what kind of lives we really do have, and so that they know that we live in a home, that we do have health care, that our kids do have access to a pretty good public education system, and that they can, well, that they can be me. All right? I mean, if my dad would have had to live under the same kind of circumstances that he had when he got to Minnesota and my grandmother, I wouldn't be here. I mean, that just wouldn't have happened. I'd be one of those billion trying to make it on a dollar a day. And I think that there's some things here that we best pay attention to. And as a nation, for sure, we best pay attention to them.
Darren, your question, please.
Yeah, this is Darren from Adrian. My question is, what legislation has Senator Janicek worked on, specifically in the state Senate, worked on or authored that he would like to kind of carry with him to the United States Senate?
Darren, I think that the whole education stuff is probably where I'm the best at. I spent the last 8 years in the Senate doing that. And I think one of the things that have gotten away from us is the fact that both now everybody goes to work. I think Minnesota has one of the highest percentages of families working. And what's happening is that at birth, education, I believe, begins at birth. And currently what we do, we drop our children off at daycare or infant care. So I believe that we better have infant care and quality daycare second to none. I mean, it has to be second to none. We better make sure that everything we do on the bottom side of a child's life from 0 to 7, 0 to 8 is the best it can be. In the last 5 to 6 years, 7 years in Minnesota, we've been building prisons and juvenile centers. All that money that we've spent there, for all practical purposes, was for the wrong things. And I think that's because society changed, we didn't change. We need to make sure that our kids have that, the most basic things. I guess I was offering breakfast programs for our children long before it was popular, and that was part of what I saw something happening, even in my own house. When two people are going to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, number one, it's pretty chaotic. And number two, sometimes the kids get through without having something to eat. And you should have that available, even if it's on a, some sort of a sliding fee scale. I've been to our schools, all our elementary schools, and I've seen kids that when they're finished eating breakfast, because we do provide it now in a lot of schools, when they're finished breakfast coming through and looking at the food server's line and the food server and saying, can I take that roll for my treat? I mean, that shouldn't happen in this country. It shouldn't happen anywhere. And it's happening. It's happening in our schools in Minnesota. And if we give them those basic needs, a Head Start program that's fully funded, we won't build prisons and juvenile centers, and we won't have probation officers. We won't have kids, what I think is kind of, we do have areas where we're putting them now in buildings where we're putting our kids when they're picking them up after the second time or third time being delinquent. We're putting them in rooms and putting in TVs and teaching them separately. I mean, those kinds of things just shouldn't be happening. Not today, not in this day and age. So I think those are the kinds of things and the passion I'm for sure I bring to the U.S. Senate on that. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about a public school system that does work, but that does need help. That federal government committed to spending money up to 40% of special education costs. I think they're at 17 or 18% of what they're paying. If we could just free that amount of money into our public school system, it would be a big deal. The current U.S. Senator, Grams, have we ever heard him talk about education? I mean, it's just not there. Those kinds of things need to be talked about. I think I've been an advocate on affordable housing. Does Grams talk about affordable housing? Not at all, because he doesn't know anything about it. We've been part of that. In the Senate, I've been one of the people that have been one of the leaders on that. Economic development. We in this state, okay, and I can only talk about in this state, we in this state have 1,100 to 1,400 businesses that are ready to expand. Well, we should create incentives for them to expand in a couple of different spots, I believe. We want them to expand in rural Minnesota, and we want them to expand in our core cities. If we can get them to do that, you start containing urban sprawl, and you start changing traffic patterns, and you start giving people opportunities closer to their potential, closer to where they might work and live at the same time. Nobody talks about those kinds of things. Those are the kinds of things I can bring and be an advocate for. I have a long way to go. I admit that. I don't have a lot of money. I admit that. But I have more heart, and I actually have more knowledge than most people give me credit for. And they didn't when I started this campaign, and maybe they never will. But when it's all said and done, what they're going to find is that Jerry Janicich cares about people. He knows a lot about a lot of stuff, and it all pertains to people's lives. And they're also going to find out that as the DFL-endorsed candidate, he's going to be very difficult to beat.
But Senator, you've laid out a list of programs, if you will, that address obvious needs. But where's the money going to come from at the federal level to pay for all of this? I mean, to provide really solid child care across the country, early childhood education, improve the education system, housing programs, all of that taken together ends up to be a pretty hefty price tag, doesn't it?
Gary, we do a ton of things with just tax codes, tax law, and it's about prioritizing. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. When you get there, you have to put things, and we do this all the time, all right, in government. We do it all the time. You set some priorities for any given budget session, and you go out and you try to meet those priorities. You move money. Some from places where you may be having success or you may not be having success, and you make those kinds of decisions, and we make them in the legislature all the time. Government makes them all the time. We would be part of making that decision. Those are the kinds of things I would prioritize. We do a reasonable amount of corporate welfare with tax structure. Why wouldn't we structure that to encourage growth in core cities in rural Minnesota? In this day and age where the technology is available, we should be able to do that. And there are examples out there. There are examples in my Senate district. Northwest Airlines is providing up to 600 jobs in my Senate district because the technology is available, okay, and because we did some things when they wanted to all the money from the state back a few years ago, we put some pressure on them on how they could help, all right, and how they could use some of their ability and how they could use some of our tax breaks or whatever they were looking for at that time. And we put some pressure to do that. Finger Hut is there. Northwest Airlines does World Perks out of Chisholm, Minnesota. Finger Hut does World Stuff out of Eveleth. It's doable. And I think that those are the kinds of things government can do when you prioritize and use it to the benefit of people. So it's not, Democrats are never going to, as a Democrat, I'm going to get labeled a big spender no matter what. All right? I could sit here and talk to you about tax cuts for the rich, and they're going to come here and they're going to say, oh, he's a Democrat, he's a tax and spend liberal. I'm going to get labeled that. I know it. I don't care. All right? That's a given. That's a given. What I care about is that people, I believe, will vote for who they think is going to give them a good day's work, an honest attempt at trying to make it work for their lives, and who cares about them. When all is said and done, they're going to find that I can do that for them. And it's going to be this guy from Chisholm, Minnesota, who's got a college degree, who's a small businessman, but he started out in behind that small businessman, behind the bar, and now he's a state senator, and he's going to be a U.S. senator. I believe that in all my heart, because I believe that the people of Minnesota and this country actually need somebody like me.
We're just about out of time, but I want to get one more caller on here. University of Minnesota physician Steve Miles is on the line. And, of course, Dr. Miles was in contention for that DFL endorsement as well. Hi, Dr. Miles.
Good morning. How are you, Gary?
Just fine. Quick comment from you before we wrap up.
Good luck, Jerry. I'm behind you all the way.
You know, I want to tell everybody this. That is one of the nicest men that I know. And every time I think, I still almost cry. You know, he and I had a pretty good cry. And I love you, Steve, and I love your wife and your children. And I'm looking forward to you helping me, because I know I'm not an expert on all the things that you are. And I'm hoping that you help me.
I'll be there, Jerry. Thanks a lot.
Nope, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, Senator, are you going to tote your soapbox around the state during your campaign?
And that's the goal. We're going to start today, and we're going to go out, and we're going to touch people. On Saturday and Sunday, we're going to be in parades. We're going to go out. We're going to touch people. We're going to we had some fun yesterday in St. Paul. You know, granted, people look at you and they think, well, look at who's this nut, but I'm used to that. You know, there's those that said, who's this nut? Then there were those that said, good for you, congratulations. And there's those who put the sticker on and said, yeah, let's go, we're happy for you. And that's the way it works. And in September, Minnesotans will decide, DFL Minnesotans will decide. I'll live with that. And I'll go out and help whoever beats me if they think they can. And I would expect the same from them. And the goal is going to be to change the attitude of one U.S. senator currently representing us. And I think we're going to win.
Thanks for coming in today, and good luck to you.
It's a pleasure, Gary. Anytime, anytime.
Chisholm State Senator Jerry Janicich, who is now the DFL party's endorsed candidate for the U.S. Senate seat, currently held by Republican Rod Grams. Now, of course, the Republicans have their convention coming up this coming weekend, Friday and Saturday, down in Rochester. We'll be back in Rochester for live coverage from the Republican Party state convention. We'll be hearing from Senator Grams, among other things. So another busy weekend of politics here in Minnesota. Stay tuned to Minnesota Public Radio.
In a brash attempt to break through the backstabbing and politics as usual of Republicans fighting Democrats on Capitol Hill, a new group has emerged. They're called the New Democrat Coalition. Composed of 65 House members, the coalition wants to move their party to the center on trade, economic, and high technology issues. I'm Juan Williams. Join us for a look at the New Democrat Coalition next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Over the noon hour, we're going off to the press club to hear from former President Gerald Ford.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 5th of June, 2000. It's the birthday of playwright David Hare, born in St. Leonard's, Sussex, England, 1947. Author of Racing Demon, Murmuring Judges, Absence of War, many, many other plays. His most recent to appear in New York was Amy's View last year. David Hare, who said, "When people are confronted with a real work of art, Then they discover that they don't believe what they thought they believed all along. In a way, the great art, the great subversive art, is art that makes you realize that you don't think what you thought you did. It's the birthday of novelist Margaret Drabble, born in Sheffield, England, 1939, the sister of novelist A.S. Byatt, author of A Summer Birdcage, The Garrick Year, The Millstone, The Witch of Exmoor, and many other books. It's the birthday of journalist Bill Moyers, born in Hugo, Oklahoma, 1934. He grew up in Marshall, Texas, in a blue-collar family. Moyers said Marshall, Texas was a wonderful place to be poor if you had to be poor. It was a genteel poverty in which people knew who you were and kind of looked after you. Status was important in Marshall, but more important was being part of the community. He served as Lyndon Johnson's chief of staff and then as his press secretary. He quit in 1967. He edited the newspaper Newsday and then took off on a 13,000-mile trip across the country with a tape recorder and put together his book, Listening to America. Since then has done TV interviews that later came out as books. It was on this day in 1900, novelist Stephen Crane died in a tuberculosis sanitarium in Germany. He was 28 years old. He died of tuberculosis complicated by malaria, which he caught while covering the Spanish-American War, and further complicated by overwork, trying to support his family through writing. It's the birthday of poet and playwright Federico García Lorca, born in Fuente Vaquero, Spain, 1898. Famous for his plays Blood Wedding, Yerma, The House of Bernardo Alba, and for his many poems. He was admired for his poetry, but resisted publishing it, saying verses meant to be recited in a book, it is dead. He came out with his Gypsy Ballads in 1928. He was assassinated by the fascists at the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War in 1936. It's the birthday of anthropologist Ruth Benedict in New York City, 1887, famous for her book Zuni Mythology. Came out in 1935 after 11 years of studying the folklore of the Pueblo, Apache, Blackfoot, and Serrano tribes. And it was on this day in 1851 the first installment of Uncle Tom's Cabin, or Life Among the Lowly, came out in a magazine called The National Era by Harriet Beecher Stowe, who'd been outraged by passage of the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850. The book came out the following year, 1852. It was a sensation, sold 300,000 copies, and did as much as any single book to lead to the Civil War. Here's a poem by Walt Whitman, Sometimes with One I Love. Sometimes with one I love, I fill myself with rage, for fear I effuse unreturned love. But now I think there is no unreturned love. The pay is certain one way or another. I loved a certain person ardently, and my love was not returned. Yet, out of that, I have written these songs. Walt Whitman's poem, Sometimes with One I Love. That's the Writer's Almanac for Monday, June 5th, made possible by 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find more than 10 million used, rare, and antiquarian books on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Be well. Do good work and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
We have news headlines coming up next, and then we'll hear from former President Gerald Ford at the National Press Club.
On Monday's All Things Considered, over two dozen Fillmore County residents plan to sue the MPCA for approving a proposed 7-million-gallon manure lagoon. It's All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. We have a fair sky, 58 degrees at KNRW FM, 91.1 Minneapolis.